Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Oshman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Oshman Family JCC is an incubator for new expressions of Jewish identity. It creates innovative Jewish learning, celebrations, and arts programs that inspire personal connections to people and ideas from across the Jewish world. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 196, Becoming Eve. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rothberg.
And today is one of our sort of breaks from our education series, although it's actually very much related. But our guest today has just published a book that we think is really great and important, and we wanted to share it with you. Our guest today is a returning guest. We spoke with her some time ago when we talked about the Jewish leaders of the Women's March. Abby Stein is a 10th generation descendant of the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of Hasidism. And as the first child in her family who was perceived to be a boy, Abby Stein was poised to become a leader of the next generation of Hasidic Jews. But Abby realized at a young age that she was a girl. She then experienced an odyssey in multiple respects, transitioning out of her ultra-Orthodox community and coming out as a woman. Abby Stein received rabbinical ordination before leaving the Hasidic world, and as she has said, she may be the first woman to be a Hasidic rabbi. Abby Stein has been named by the New York Jewish Week as one of the 36 people under 36, the people to watch in the community, and in 2019, she served on the steering committee for the Women's March in Washington, D.C. Her book, Becoming Eve, was published earlier this week. It's subtitled My Journey from Ultra-Orthodox Rabbi to Transgender Woman. And it's a great read and a great story of a coming of age. We're looking forward to discussing some of that story here in our interview today. And again, we encourage you all to read this wonderful book. Abby Stein, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's so great to have you back on.
Thank you so much, Dan and Lex. It's great to be back.
Well, last time we talked, it was about your leadership in the Women's March, and now you have just published your first memoir. I think you're hoping that there are going to be more. This one is called Becoming Eve, and as you have said to us, it is a coming-of-age story rather than what people might expect, something like a coming-out story. And I am wondering if you could just share with us a little bit of the story of what it was like to be as you understood yourself to be a girl in the body of a boy in this Hasidic world.
I want to just correct you there very quickly. I actually don't like to use, I mean, personally, some people do want to use it. Personally, I don't like to use a girl like in the body or like wrong body. I never really felt it that way. To me, it was always like, I'm a girl. And I don't think I ever separated who I am from my body. I have a very comfortable relationship with my body today, and even right like before transition, unfortunately, yes, I was struggling with gender dysphoria, but it was never so much as, oh, I got to get rid of this body, and more like, we got to take care of a few things. Now, yeah, as you said, the book is very much focused on, as it's called, like becoming Eve rather than being Eve. It's becoming who I was, and it's the growing up story. And that actually was a bit of a last minute decision, because initially we were going to kind of like cover everything. Let's say chronologically, I was going to have the book go until 2015, when in reality, it kind of ends in 2012. And a big part of that is because I started realizing there were so many stories to tell. And even with it as it is, there's still a lot of stories about my youth and childhood that didn't make it in. The way I look at it, there's kind of like three parts here. There is growing up in a fundamentalist religious community. And I think people who grew up in other religious communities, and I know I have a lot of friends like that, some really close ones, and grew up in other fundamentalist communities. And there are some similarities kind of across the board that I think a lot of people want to learn more. It's an important subject to talk about. There's obviously the part of growing up with a gender identity that wasn't the norm. I mean, to be honest, we're talking here in the 90s, and that unfortunately wasn't the norm anywhere, but specifically in the religious community where I grew up. So growing up, struggling with gender and trying to fit in. And I know for anyone who has read the book, you see that constantly, and it constantly comes up, and it goes hand in hand with my experience going through that like fundamentalist religious upbringing. But I think the third part, and maybe the most important part that I really hope that everyone could relate to, I simply see it as a story of growing up. I think everyone has an interesting story. And everyone, so many of these ideas of who am I, how do I fit into my community, how do I fit into my family, are ultimately just things that every human being deals with. And I just think that I've been given the opportunity because the story has these radical extremes. I always say that, like, my before and after pictures, yes, they look a bit more radical than most. Hopefully that can help other people to just relate to their own.
So I'd love to dive a little deeper into this, into the point you made about fundamentalism and how, so you grew up in a fundamentalist Jewish group. You have friends who are from other kinds of fundamentalist backgrounds. I'd love to really get a sense from you. You mentioned that there's commonalities, and I think some of them might be intuitive to us, but to the extent that you could flesh that out, like, what are some of the common threads across religious traditions that manifest when you are deeply in a fundamentalist community, like what you experienced, like what your friends that you talked about could experience? And also, on the flip side of that, to the extent that there are pieces that really are unique to growing up in an ultra-Orthodox kind of community, what would you name those as being?
So I think, obviously, you mentioned there's the obvious similarities. I think the way they look on gender, the way they look on sexuality, the way they perceive themselves as being better than everyone else, which I think is almost across the board a fundamentalist idea. The way that looking down on other people, which comes with it, and it's the thing that I've learned that both in my community and other communities, it always comes with a mix of disdain and hate, but at the same time, a bit of pity. Like, we always grew up, oh, so sad, all of these non-religious Jews or all of these non-Jews who are just gonna, like, not go to heaven the way we perceived it and so on. And the same exists in other communities. But I think the parts that maybe some people don't realize, like, on the surface level right away, that I have been able to flush out, as you say, through my friends. So a big example would be, I have a friend, one of my very close friends now, her name's Kate Kelly. Her and I and two of our other friends co-founded this thing called Sacred Space, which is a monthly gathering of women from all different backgrounds hosted through The Wing in New York. And we talk a lot, and she grew up in a Mormon community, was excommunicated when she started this organization called Ordained Women. And one of the things that we have started realizing a lot, it's also the response that they have to people who come and want to change something. So instead of seeing, let's take for a Jewish example, like Woman of the Wall. Okay, we're not going to go into, I think we all have our complicated relationships with everything that's happening in that whole area, but specifically talking about just that subject as an example.
Women of the Wall is an organization fighting for the right of women to pray equally at the Western Wall in Jerusalem.
And people always wonder, why do ultra-Orthodox people get so worked up and so hateful for women who are just trying to come and do their own thing? But the way the Hasidic community, and I grew up there, so I know that the way they see it when, let's say, a forum group is coming and trying to do their own thing, and they're not even trying to change their life, just have their own rights, the way they see it is as people who are coming to attack them. For them, when there's a woman who doesn't like to sit on behind a mechitza, who doesn't like to sit behind the wall that is dedicated for women, they don't see it as a woman who wants equal rights. They see it as a woman that is out there to destroy us. When I have started my work, they don't see me as a LGBTQ person, as a trans person who's trying to help trans people who are literally being killed and literally die from so many different issues, just trying to help them support. What they hear, what they see, is someone is out here to destroy us. And I think when we look on that, it helps a lot for us to get a perspective. The same like in political fields, a lot of people are like, why does it bother you so much about equality? Because unfortunately, something that tends to be true across the board in fundamentalist communities is that it's a bit of a narcissistic tendency where they live in their own world, so everything is about them. So women asking for equality is not about women asking for equality, it's about women asking to destroy their way of life. And we see that a lot with same-sex marriage. It's all these arguments, oh, same-sex marriage is going to destroy marriage. I'm always like, how is giving more people the right to get married going to destroy the institute of marriage? I honestly don't get it. And sometimes when it's a group of people that is worth interacting with, we also got to be careful and being able to like, hey, you live your life. We're not out here to destroy you. We're just trying to have equality for us. And I think that is one very important detail that is true. And there's a lot of other things. I mean, we find that pretty much every fundamentalist communities have ways of controlling people's money, people's sex life. and education. That is usually three things that exist across, I mean, across religious communities as a whole, but even more so in fundamentalist communities. And these tend to be the most important things. Like for us growing up, someone who didn't adhere to the sexual kind of rules or what most people did wasn't just considered someone who is like doing that small thing. Like someone who like broke Shabbat secretly and no one knew about it. Yeah, okay, it was a problem. Someone who went out and had sex with a person outside of marriage, oh, that person was done. And that exists throughout communities. And I think in New York, we're seeing that now with education. The fight that they're putting up, there was actually a letter that I saw yesterday that came out from a whole group of rabbis, including my father, that also signed on it, fighting back against the attempt for better education in the Hasidic community. They don't see that as just an attempt for better education. They see that as an attempt to destroy them.
And I'd like to go back to explore that stuff a little bit later, because I'm also thinking back to our conversation with Shulam Dean from a couple of years ago, who also left ultra-Orthodoxy. And in my years of reflecting on that conversation later, I realized it was much more important even than I thought at the time, because I felt that the things that he was describing about the ultra-Orthodox community are true in different ways of all communities and certainly of other Jewish communities, and are not really understood that way and are not learned from by other Jewish communities, because we say, hey, we're not like them. They're fundamentalists. They're crazy.
Can I jump, before I forget, yeah. I really need to say that. And I alluded to it a bit before, but I think it's one of the most important things. And I tell that to people a lot during my presentations. I've given over 300 speeches and it comes up a lot. People like to say that, oh, these things only happen there. You know, whatever it's, these things only happen in like the Middle East or in Africa or whatever, it's, these things only happen in these fundamentalist communities. When in reality, all these fundamentalist communities are radical examples of stuff that unfortunately exists throughout society. Take sexism, for example. We think, oh, like in the Hasidic community, it's very open. Every time there's something wrong, it's the woman who are not dressed modest enough. You know, the woman who are covered head to toe, they're not dressed modest enough. And then you're like, oh my God, these people are just whatever. But then you think about it, it's everywhere in society. Oh, but how was she dressed? And there's such a focus on it. It's just on a lower level. And I think that is actually where formerly fundamentalist people have a huge gift to give to society as a whole, which is, listen to our story, and it's easier to understand it because it's so radical, but don't just focus on that. Think about how much these same ideas, maybe on a less radical level, exist in every facade of society.
So I think that it'll help us to paint that picture a little bit by telling a few of the stories from the beginning of your book, not with the spoilers, because I was particularly taken with a story from early on in your book about the deal that was arranged between your father's family and your mother's family about what color stockings your mother was going to wear after she got married. And I think that gives a little bit of a window into this world and also into our world. So can you tell that story? Because I just think it's
sure.
really fascinating.
I don't know. I feel like that's one of the best stories in the book. I don't want to spoil it.
But it's early on in the book, so I feel
okay.
like it's legit.
I will give the snapshot of it. So here's the thing. I know it sounds stupid when you think about it, because both sides of my family, my mom's family and my dad's family, both wear tights that there's no way in the world that anyone would think that it's skin color. We call them bulletproof stockings for a reason. But in my mom's side of the family, they wear what I would say most Hasidic people in Brooklyn and a lot of Hasidic people as a whole wear, which is they wear beige colored tights that have a seam in the back, because even the beige color doesn't look like skin ever, but just to make sure even more, it has a seam in the back so everyone could tell that it's tights. Fine. On my dad's side of the family, specifically coming from my grandmother, who comes from an old kind of like Yerushalmi Jerusalem family, like we call them the Sabras, but like not in the modern Israeli version of it, but part of the what's called the Yeshuva Yashan, the people who have lived in Israel, pre-state Israel in Jerusalem, and so on. And they have a lot of stricter rules. And one of them is black tights. They consider every color that's not black to not be religious enough. And then as the match was happening, and for my grandfather on my dad's side and my grandmother, it was their fourth kid getting married. And the previous three, which were one daughter and two sons, all of them, this means their daughter and their two daughter-in-law so far, started wearing black tights. And they made sure of it. And now it got to my mom, and my grandparents wanted my mom to put on black tights. And my mom's family wasn't really excited about it. And the reason, which is, again, you would think, why do you really care? But it's like black tights is considered overall, at least like gossiply, I don't know if that's a word, gossiply, but in the talk on the street is always that is considered more religious. And they were like, we don't want our daughter or our sister to wear something that is considered more religious.
Also because it would almost be an implication that they're not religious enough.
Yeah, but at the same time, they would still say, and my grandmother, my mom's mom, said that to me until the last day. Like, she wasn't really here, but like, as long as she was talking, she would always say that she thinks that the tights that they're wearing is just as religious, if not even more. Fine. They were fighting back and forward about it, and it was like, literally almost got to a standstill, which sounds super ironic. You're talking about two people, and in my family, even today, there are not a lot of options, because they only marry people who also come from rabbinic families who have the similar dress code. So many things have got to line up, and they're in the world probably just a handful of possibilities, and we're talking here 30, 40 years ago, and there were even less options. But still, it got to a point where my grandmother insisted on black tights, my dad's mom, and my mom's family was not really happy about that. They came to a solution where my mom was going to wear gray tights, which they somehow considered to be either just as good, like my great-grandma on my dad's side said that's just as good as black. And on my mom's side, they tried to sell the story that that is even better. Like there's one part, like a whole group of my kind of like aunt's kids and grandkids who also live in Williamsburg, that they only wear gray tights. And the only reason why I could see that be more religious is because it's uglier. Like I really don't understand how that is more religious, but that is how they considered it. So my mom started wearing gray tights. I think the rest of the story, it gets even more. The story continues as when I was born and later when I left the community. But I think I will let people read that story in the book. But yeah, it is an example. And like, I think when people listen to it, they were like, oh my God, like these people are not normal. Like really? You make such a big deal on a tights color? But I want us to try to imagine how many times in the outside world, so to speak, we make statements about how long someone's dress is and how tight a woman's dress is and which kind of clothes that they wear. We make such a big deal out of it. But ultimately, clothing is just like gender, a social construct.
Yeah, I mean, I remember walking around at my school growing up that was not religiously affiliated, but it was a private school and there was a dress code, and there were teachers that would walk around with rulers to measure whether the skirts that girls were wearing were long enough.
Yeah.
And I've heard that they don't do that anymore, thank God. But that's, you know, at a theoretically secular school.
No, in the Hasidic community, they do that. And there's all these rules. Like, ideally, a woman's skirt or dress has to be 4 inches below the knee, but still be 10 inches above the ground, or 8, if you're good. Because if it's too long, it's also not modest enough. So there's like this tiny kind of window of how long it can be. And yes, exactly as you say, we might think that, in religious communities, these things are more proclaimed. But the way I think we should look, people on the outside, which is probably going to be the majority of people reading my book, our focus should be on not on, oh, this is a cool story that is so radical it doesn't apply to us, but rather, okay, this is a cool story that points out something in a radical way, and how does it affect us in our lives?
Yeah, that's huge. That's really huge. I want to ask you to, once again, you know, we're towing this spoiler line, but if you can talk to us a little bit about how, when you were growing up, you experienced your gender identity and some of your challenges, some of your struggles, some of your whatever comes to mind. Like, what was your early journey around gender as a child living in a Hasidic community?
In an ironic twist, that almost helped me a bit because it was the boundary was so clear. I mean, it's obviously a genetic boundary, but the boundary between man and woman was so clear that I was very comfortable identifying as a girl and feeling like this is the side that I belong to and not that side. But it took on different ways. And throughout the book, I'm actually a few times very careful in saying that what I felt, I'm not saying that is what it means to be a girl. And I think every single one of these things, you can be like, yeah, that doesn't mean to be a girl. And I think it's more the sum total of the experience. And I'm also very aware that I think throughout my childhood, my brain would subconsciously pick up on something and be like, this is what it means to be a woman, and therefore like it. So it's sometimes really hard for me to differentiate what was really innate because this is what I felt, and what was more that my brain identified that as feminine, therefore like it. A few examples are like, there's a story about a toy when I was 2 years old that is actually one of the first times that I remember very clearly thinking to myself, I'm a girl, and why does everyone disagree with that? There's a story a three-year-old when I had my first haircut. I think some of the strongest stories that I'm not going to spoil, because go read it, is something physical that I attempted to do when I was 4 years old. I think all of these things coming together But it's very clear that kind of my desire, my understanding of what it means to be a woman was buying into the story of being a housewife and having a lot of kids, which was the story that I was told. So there's all these different ideas of what it meant to be a woman. There are some things, however, that I liked back then. And back then they were very feminine, and today they aren't necessarily feminine. Like, I loved cooking and I still love cooking. But growing up, cooking was a purely like only woman specifically. There was some man who cooked, but the cooking was the purview of woman. And now I'm in a world where not necessarily, I mean, yes, but again, there's still the stereotype of woman belonging in the kitchen. But that is another, it's an example of something that I liked regardless, but growing up that meant being a woman. Gender is to some extent a made up identity. But that could be beautiful. There's nothing wrong with identifying as feminine or masculine if it's in a healthy way. It's made up, and I'm very much aware of that. Like, for example, right now, I am fairly stereotypical feminine with long hair and love makeup and the clothes that I wear. There's nothing wrong with that, I think, as long as we're aware of where it comes from.
I want to get back to something that you were talking about earlier when you talked about fundamentalist communities controlling money, education, and sex. And I'm curious about exploring this question of the internet in light of that, because I think that we talked about it with Sholem Dean as well, that in the Hasidic or ultra-Orthodox communities, there's a fear of the internet that if people are exposed to literally the place where you can get any ideas, I mean, it used to be fears of public libraries, and now it's also the internet, you know, that you're going to be able to find stuff out, that if you find that out, it's going to lead you to leave. And in the case of Sholem and in your case, there's an element of truth to that, right? That you had these feelings your whole life and it's not clear what would have happened if you, you know, and I guess that my question also is, what do you think sort of happens to with folks who never find the internet? But, you know, it was through the internet that you understood that there was such a thing as transgender. And wow, there is another place in the world where I could go where some of my ideas and some of who I am, it might still be hard, but it's a lot less hard than this place. And so I guess that what I'm interested in is kind of what would you say to a ultra-Orthodox leader, you know, that says, you know, I'm afraid of these things and there is that element. And so how should a fundamentalist community deal with sources of education and information that are external?
We could go into details of how exactly they should, but one thing that is very clear how they shouldn't is the way the Hasidic community approaches it, which is, oh, don't go on the internet at all. It almost doesn't work. And to be honest, as I mentioned in the book a bit, I don't go into that in detail, and maybe in the sequel we'll talk more about that. I only knew about what the internet is from being told what not to do. I think I get it. A lot of people are concerned because people find information online. My response to that usually first off, and I literally told that to my father many times, what does it say about your community and about your belief system if it can't hold up to any criticism? They are arguing that it's not a question of, oh, some people who go online will end up going off. The arguments, what they say, whatever they believe in it fully or not is a separate conversation, is that everyone, they use kind of like what Shulam's title of the book is called Be'e Olo Yeshivan, like all who go do not return. They really say that with anyone who goes online. And I'm like, what does that really say about your belief system? I've worked with Jewish communities who have a very non-critical approach when it comes to Israel and Palestine, for example. And I'm like, I always tell them, It's a bad idea because ultimately these people are going to be exposed. Like whatever, it's at a camp that doesn't give a critical education and then these students end up on a college campus where they are exposed to it anyway. I think the same thing is happening in the Hasidic community. I would say around 50% of the Hasidic community have some internet access. The impressive part is that 50% don't, but it's not an exact number. It isn't an exact statistic. But on average, so many people do. A lot of them do have a filtered internet, but even a filtered internet, you can't filter everything out. And specifically, ultimately, once people know, and everyone knows that there is the internet, people who want to get to the internet will get to the internet. I think I'm a good example. I never went on the internet until I was 20. And then the first time I was online, I learned about the trans community. You can't hide it, even if you want to. So there is a healthy internet approach. Take Chabad, for example, right? They have totally embraced the internet. And yes, they have slightly higher rates of people leaving, but I don't think that has anything to do with the internet. It's been like that forever because they're a relatively more open community. yet so many of them still stay religious. I would gamble and say that Chabad has a higher rate of people who are online who stay religious than pretty much any other Hasidic community, because they have a, what I would say, a healthier approach. I'm not saying the healthiest, but a healthier approach to the internet, which is, yes, there's a lot of information here, but we gotta be careful with what you read. We gotta understand. You give people the tools. I think a Hasidic community could be like, yes, go online, do whatever you want, but know that if you have questions, here's a list of websites where you can go. However, they don't want people to ask questions. And you see that in the book, What Happens When I Ask Questions in eighth grade. Their approach is just not healthy from neither a religious or a human point of view. And I think, I do believe, as much as I would disagree probably with whatever idea they come up with, I do believe they could come up with a way to expose people to the internet in a healthier way.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring up Chabad. I think that's a really interesting example of a form of ultra-Orthodoxy that's very much living in the world, and that, you know, it, yes, in some ways does, but in other ways doesn't have these high barriers where it's trying to keep things out. I also think about the Amish and the idea of the Rumspringa, where they actually send young people out for some time and say, hopefully they'll come back.
I do want to say something about that. I do have a few friends that I met through formerly fundamentalist communities that grew up Amish. And to be honest, they always say, oh, we have such a high rate of coming back. Rumspringa is not all good. I mean, even from a open-minded perspective, because what ends up happening is that they send people out without any tools. For someone who grew up, I mean, I'm thinking myself, without the help of an organization like Footsteps, I wouldn't have survived in the outside world. It was impossible, and neither would so many other people who leave. And unfortunately, so many, like I see that right now, they've unfortunately been, and I want to say a trigger warning, I'm going to talk about suicide, so if anyone who doesn't want to talk, maybe skip the next 2 minutes. But there is a very high rate of suicide amongst people leaving the ultra-Orthodox community. I mean, thankfully, people who joined Footsteps, they have a really low rate. They have had 3 suicides throughout their existence of 15 years with over 1,500 members, which is 3 too many, but it's a lot lower than it is amongst people who don't join them. And just saying, oh, you can go out and you have options. No, you don't. They always say, oh, we don't force anyone to stay. If you don't want to stay, you can leave. No, you can't. You don't speak the language. You have no education. You don't know how the outside world works.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that the question that you're raising about the Amish and the Rumspringa goes in 2 directions, right? One, it says that if you send people out without really being able to deal with the world outside, first of all, something terrible can happen to them. And the other possibility is that they find it so difficult to live there that they come back, but not for the right reasons, in the sort of global sense, but for the reason that they actually can't live well there. And that's not great either.
I don't want to say the exact numbers, and I don't know if it's 50% or close to that, but I think a huge percent of people who stay Hasidic, I'm not even talking about the people who leave, don't do it because it's what they really believe in. They don't do it because they're convinced that that is the right way of living. They do it because it's the only life they know. It's where their family is. So many of them are financially fully dependent on the Hasidic community, and they have no way of surviving in the outside world. They don't know how to dress, how to order food. They don't know anything about the outside world. And that is not the right reason why someone should stay in a community. And I know, like, my dad told me that once openly when I started, when I was 19, right after I got finished my rabbinical studies, my dad, I was tutoring kind of students, teens at risk in the Hasidic sense, not really at risk of drugs or anything, but at risk of, I don't know, hanging out with girls or having smartphones, that kind of at risk. And one of the things that he told me then is you just gotta try to keep these kids in until they get married. Then you just marry them off and they're stuck, so to speak. Think about that for a second. What does that say about a society that so much of it is not that this is the right way, it's just like you have no other option? Which again, though, and I'm going to tie that back to what we're talking about before, so much of what we do in society as a whole follows a similar logic. Like, I think a lot about college education. It's not necessarily that you need the college education for so many things that you do, that it's more like you have no other option and you better do that and get into $100,000 in debt because there's no other way you're gonna succeed. Which is something that we have created, and we do that in so many parts. We create a society, we create a culture, then we're like, okay, but there is no other choice and you have to do that.
I want to bring up a thread that has come up a number of times over the course of our podcast. Initially, not with somebody who was formerly Orthodox, but with Yehuda Kurtzer, I believe. But then we also spoke about it with Shulam Dean. We've spoken about it with a number of guests. What Yehuda Kurtzer talked about was the B'nai Brak test. B'nai Brak, for those who aren't familiar, is ultra-Orthodox community in Israel.
I would say it's equivalent to the Bar Park neighborhood in Brooklyn.
Right. And what he was talking about is he was asking an open-ended question of about Jewish peoplehood. That's where I'm going with this, basically. Where he was asking, like, look, ultimately there's a huge question to wrestle with, which is, do I or we or whoever feel like we are really, for those of us who are not Orthodox, like, do we feel that we are part of a shared project with somebody, for him, in B'nai Brak or in Borough Park, in wherever it is? Do we feel that, like, we are really similar to each other in enough ways that we would be part of the same project? Or do we think we're sort of different projects? And then we got into a whole layer of things. We started talking about the idea of Judaism as a family, where even when family members aren't really seeing eye to eye, like, they're still part of a family. And we got down that path. But what I was thinking about the whole time, and what we've talked about since then, is that for me, like, I don't feel the same set of emotional connections to, let's say, to Orthodox institutions as I do to non-Orthodox institutions. Like, just my body feels different. It feels like I'm looking at something external to me when I'm interacting with Orthodox institutions. When I know Orthodox people, I connect to them deeply, but there haven't been enough people in my life who are Orthodox that I really feel like when I'm doing Jewish, I'm sort of doing something that is part of the same system as them. But at the same time, I have this deep appreciation for the idea of Jewish collectivity that would transcend differences in how we approach it. So it's, like, really hard. And I spend a lot of time wrestling with this. And I wanted to ask you, because, like, you literally have family, close family. And so I wanted to ask you for your take on this. Like, how should we, or how could we think about this B'nai Brak test? Like, this idea of, are we part of a shared project with these folks? Or maybe more accurately, like, in what ways are we part of a shared project, and in what ways aren't we?
So, do we have enough in common with them? It's a very strong yes and a very strong no. I think one thing that people miss a lot when it comes to the ultra-Orthodox community is the fact that so much of who they are is cultural, not religious. To put it more in different terms, I sometimes find that my friend who grew up Mormon understands me better than modern Orthodox Jews. I'm talking, she has a better sometimes understanding when I mention certain things about family life, about clothing, about the approach to gender and sexuality. I sometimes have more in common with the Amish than I have with any other Jew. And I remember that there was this other girl who was for one semester at Columbia. She was doing a program here, grew up Amish. And I had more in common with her than with her. It was my first semester in college as well. And culturally, sometimes I had more in common with her than with any of the Jews on campus. And Columbia has a lot of Jews and a diverse Jewish community. At the same time, when you move over to focus on the religious part, then yes, we have a very strong overlap. And specifically with American Jews, but not just American Jews, but Jews as a whole. The concepts of Shabbat and holidays, so many of the songs, like when I could literally walk, because I grew up Orthodox, I can walk into any synagogue in the world, from conservative to reconstructionist, renewal, reform, humanistic, any new version, and I'm going to find at least partially some parts to be recognizable. I think anyone who grew up in a synagogue, maybe it will be harder the other way around, but still, you will recognize some parts. So I think the part, and then again, if you look on my favorite parts about Judaism are always life cycle and year cycle. I always say that. I think we have a very, very strong message to the world and to everyone there. And that is the part where, yes, Jews across the board, including ultra-Orthodox Hasidic Jews, have stuff in common. But I want to focus on another part. Sometimes it's a one-sided love. Actually, let me correct, not sometimes, almost always. When a person like Yehuda Kurtzer, who I admire and who I've studied with both at Columbia and at Hartman, when someone like Yehuda Kurtzer is like, okay, how do we go and how do we approach the Orthodox community? Typically, let's talk the ultra-Orthodox community, not Orthodox. That's very different. They don't consider you part of them. They almost never do. To some extent, they see non-ultra-Orthodox Jews as a bigger danger than the outside world, than the non-Jewish world. And they say that very openly. People talk a lot about, oh, we got to be respectful to them. And I'm like, yes, that's amazing. But the majority, actually, let's not say the majority, the leadership. I think people on the ground, that is very important. There's diversity within the Hasidic community. There's some amazing people on the ground. But the establishment, the leadership, the formal message is never like that. I was told growing up that walking into a Reformed temple is worse than going into a church, and going into a church is one of the worst things you can do. For context, my dad, let me give you another example. My dad, the first 2 years after I left the community, my ideas of Yom Kippur was going camping with menus that consisted almost entirely of pork. You're talking totally not involved, not doing anything Jewish. And then a year after that, I joined Romumu.
Romumu is a congregation in New York City that's part of the Jewish Renewal Movement and also part of the national network called the Jewish Emergent Network.
And I went there for Yom Kippur. And I did the Haftorah on Yom Kippur morning. And they had a live stream, so I had a clip of it. And I showed it to my dad. And he told me, I would rather you don't go anywhere, which he knew meant going camping and eating pork on Yom Kippur, rather than you going to Romumu, which has mixed eating and a woman rabbi and music. And I think people who are trying to do this work of, oh, how do we engage more with the Orthodox community, sometimes either intentionally or unintentionally ignore that part, where any kind of love and respect, unfortunately, way too often is one-sided. Again, very careful. Not always, not with all people. I know people who really internalize the Kol Yisrael Arevim, that all Jews belong to each other, and the ideas of we are one group. And I agree. I don't think that the result, we should listen to this and be like, okay, I don't care about the Hasidic community anymore. I think we should care. I think it's very important for us to care, specifically because of the people in the Hasidic community and also the people leaving. And as I've said before, I think people leaving the ultra-Orthodox communities, have the ones who stay involved in Jewish communities outside of the Orthodox world, have a wealth of knowledge and information and culture and education and texts and learning to offer to the world, to the Jewish world and the world beyond. But we do got to know that to some extent, it's a bit of a one-sided conversation.
Something that really struck me in our conversation that we had with Shulam Dean that I think is also relevant here is that I asked Shulam something along the lines of, why don't more people who lose their faith in God leave ultra-Orthodoxy? Something along those lines. And he said, no, no, you've got it wrong. It's not that the people who lose their faith in God leave ultra-Orthodoxy. There are a lot of people that are living an ultra-Orthodox life that don't have faith in God. The people, for example, in what he was talking about that leave are the people who are fundamentally creative people to their core, because that world doesn't want creativity. And so if your very core is you're a creator, then it's not really a place that wants you. And I sort of took that, and I, you know, that in the conversation,
I want to jump in just before I forget. At some point, I think that is one type of people. There's no one size fits all. There's different types of people. I think creative people is a group of people. People that were abused is a group of people. LGBTQ people on its own is a group of people leaving. They are, but it usually isn't just because you lost your faith, but you were right.
Yeah. Well, that's where I'm going with this is that as I mulled over for the weeks after the interview, what he said, that it was the creative people who left because that community doesn't really want you to be creative. I mean, if you make a nice little new tune, that's fine. But if you really want to turn things upside down, they don't want you. I realize like that's not only true for ultra-Orthodoxy. That's true in Reform Judaism and Conservative Judaism and everything. I mean, if you're really, really super creative and you want to turn things upside down, like they're not going to be so thrilled to have you either for the most part. And I'd love for you to reflect a little bit, you know, hold up the mirror to the Jewish community as you've experienced it as sort of a, I don't know if we want to call it an immigrant or a visitor or somebody who's been given this entree because you're asked to speak at all these synagogues. And, you know, because I think that there's people, many people, and many of them are our listeners, who perhaps because they are trans and perhaps for all kinds of other reasons, are actually saying, look, you know, it's not so great at the various Jewish institutions that I've come into contact with either, you know, and so there's this whole, so one of the reasons why I think interviewing you is so helpful is because on the one hand, yeah, it's interesting to hear about what's going on in the ultra-Orthodox world, but that's not why we have you on the show. It's because there's a sense that your experience with ultra-Orthodoxy is actually so relevant to other folks' experience with other kinds of Jewish institutions. And I'd love it if you could reflect on what you've kind of seen in that respect.
It definitely is. And as I've said before, I think radical examples are good for us to then reflect and see how it affects us all. But I think one of the things that came to mind right away is one of the questions that I get, and I will be honest, usually comes from people who are a lot older than me, but I get that in general, even in communities that are fully progressive. I'm talking communities that invite me in, communities that invite me to come speak, to give sermons, to teach, and so on. And I still get this question, for example, a lot that, yes, we want to be very welcoming, but we think that preserving some form, usually the only people that will voice it will be a bit older people, but I see it on the need even with younger people. We still want to preserve some form of heteronormative family lifestyle. So like, they were like, yes, we're totally fine with gay people, and we're totally cool with trans people, but like, we would still want most weddings in our synagogue to be boys and girls getting married because we still want to have families. And there's all this, a certain way of how a Jewish family looks. And it's always, I say that, for example, about interfaith relationships, interfaith dialogue in general. I always say that this thing that I mentioned in the beginning, sacred space, the space for women that we have created, one of the things that I really like about it, that it's not your typical interfaith place. That tends to be either two major faiths or one faith bringing in the other. And it's amazing. It's beautiful. Like, I love when Jewish communities do interfaith events. But it's always like, we're the Jews. We're not going to change. But we welcome you and we celebrate you. I find the same thing with the LGBT community way too often. Like, we are a heteronormative straight community, but you are fully welcomed and will host your wedding and will host your Ofriv, the Shabbat before the wedding. We'll do everything for you. But we are a heteronormative society, and that unfortunately still exists. I mean, I could say from all communities that I visited, there's maybe a handful, okay, maybe two handful of communities where that is not the story. It's one of the things that I love about Romamu, and we got CBSD, which is an LGBT synagogue in New York and other places that do that. But I think what we need, yeah, there exists LGBT. That's another problem sometimes. I think LGBT communities are important and beautiful, but it runs into the same problem, that the reason why we even needed LGBT synagogues was that even communities that were hypothetically welcoming, it was always, we welcome you. I say the same, it's a bit of what I say about tolerance. I hate tolerance. I say always, my go-to is, tolerance is for lactose, not for people.
Yeah, you said that on our last episode. It was a big hit.
Yeah, people like to celebrate. And it's a bit the same thing. Like, we, even when we do celebrate, when people say, yeah, we celebrate the LGBT community, we do a Pride Shabbat, but it still has this feeling. It's more of a feeling and a culture rather than something specific, where it's still heteronormative or cisgender normative. Cisgender is pretty much everyone who's not trans, kind of normative society. And that is what we really need to focus on changing. And I think hopefully the book will also be able to get that point across.
I'm part of, you know, many Jewish spaces at various levels for each. And like, the spaces where there's a huge presence or like even a majority of people who identify as queer, like, they're not doing like a queer Shabbat every like once a year or like a queer, like, it wouldn't make any sense. It's like every week or every time that this gathering happens, there's like a flow of queerness because that's who's in the room. Like, the second you are and once again, this is not to say that if you're a congregation, like, ditch your Pride Shabbat. Like, that's not the message here. We need to strive for a situation where those kinds of things aren't needed as much, because just the rhythm all the time is one where we're bringing in those narratives.
Yeah. The way I look at it a lot is, I want to see synagogues where part of life cycle events includes namings and bar and bat mitzvahs and bee mitzvahs, hopefully, and weddings and transition celebrations and coming out celebrations. And thankfully, there are a few communities where you can do that. But when that does happen, it's like such a big deal and everyone talks about it. And most likely the community is going to try to fundraise off of that and say how progressive they are, which is okay, I guess, at the moment of where we are. But that is not the goal. That is not what we need. I think about it. The fact is that there's still a Wikipedia page that lists every LGBTQ rabbi. I'm like, that is sad.
I want to ask you before we close just one question about your Judaism and where you have positioned yourself in Jewish life and or where you want to, because I think it's also very interesting to talk to you as somebody who, after all, is actually still a young person and whose, you know, career and whose
I'm
future...
a baby with a baby. That is my go-to.
Right. You know, but and so it's interesting to me. So I guess I'm wondering, like, you know, you even just put it in a very simple frame, which is not sort of the priority, but it's actually kind of interesting and remarkable that you are a rabbi, you have rabbinical ordination. And then you left ultra-Orthodoxy. And so I guess my part of my question is whether you still think of yourself as a rabbi. Is it, do you think of yourself as somebody who, you know, is, quote, a Jewish professional or wants to be? And I guess, you know, where I'm coming from it is that you have no obligation to be whatsoever. And if you, you know, you didn't choose to really go down that path, and if you... chose another path, that would be your right. And yet, when I look at the world of people who leave ultra-Orthodoxy for whatever set of reasons, I see those folks as a potential source of an infusion of new ideas into the wider liberal Jewish community. And, you know, Lex and I worked out this idea early on in the podcast that we called the chutzpah versus knowledge curve. And we said that, you know, the people who have the chutzpah to try to change Judaism, sometimes they don't know enough to know how radical it is. And that's one kind of person who has that chutzpah to change it. But there's this, but then it tends to be that as you get more and more knowledge, many people have less and less chutzpah because people tell them what all the rules are. But then there's people who have so much knowledge that they kind of come out on the other end and say, hey, I know what the problems are and I know how it could be different. And something strikes me that people who are coming out of ultra-Orthodoxy potentially have that huge amount of knowledge that might allow them to be these chutzpahdik leaders that I yearn for in the non-ultra-Orthodox Jewish community. And I kind of see you trying to do that in various ways a little bit. And I'm just curious to have you reflect as we close on where you hope that you yourself are going to try to influence the rest of the Jewish community, and perhaps other people also coming from ultra-Orthodoxy could do that.
I used to be, for a long time, I was totally uncomfortable with the title rabbi. And then I slowly got to a point where I stopped fighting back on it. And now I'm at a point where my go-to is I say I'm a freelance rabbi, because I definitely use it and I have now steady things that I do. I definitely took my knowledge. And if you go on Sepharia, which is an online database of Jewish texts, sepharia.org, I can't be the first one on the podcast to mention it. So I have 40 source sheets on the 41, I think, wow, source sheets on Sepharia, which I've used to take in my knowledge and put together some quite radical ideas of, like, look on how Judaism spoke about it. Ironically, some of the most hate that I ever got from my former community was for some of these Jewish sources, primary sources, because it pushes people, it pushes the boundary. I do have gotten more and more comfortable and sometimes intentionally very much being aware of what I'm doing. I would be like, when someone tries to make a statement, oh, Judaism X, Y, and Z, I'm like, hold on. I'm a rabbi, and I think that is not exactly the way you say it. And I'm not ignorant to the fact that I sometimes use it in ways that some people will think that I'm abusing it, but I think it's important. And as you have said, to have the knowledge, and I'm not saying people don't have that. I strongly believe in people who are passionate, regardless of their knowledge level, should come out and speak. But I definitely think that first and foremost, they have the opportunity to challenge people who try to use Judaism as their punishing rod, as their, like, you know, as their boogeyman. I also, like, have been one of the statements that I'm very, and I constantly say that whenever someone says something that is orthodoxy, and, like, there's a lot of things, for example, oh, Judaism follows matrilineal lines. And I'm always like, hold on, Reform Judaism doesn't necessarily agree with that. And sometimes, like, people always say, okay, yes, but Reform Jews are not, but whatever. Or, like, there's some even non-Orthodox Jews who try to give up the image that Orthodoxy is the one who really knows. And then I think there's an opportunity for me and for other people who grew up ultra-Orthodox to be like, hey, no, I grew up there and I know what they have to say, and I still disagree with you even from that perspective. And I mean, there are a lot of people who grew up Hasidic and grew up ultra-Orthodox and have left who don't want to have anything to do with Judaism, and that is their choice that I fully, fully support and totally understand. But I think as you alluded to a bit, the Jewish community does have a lot to gain, and I want to see that more. It's happening a bit, but still not enough. I have it a lot in my own personal life where people freak out when they ask me somehow halachic questions from a very religious point of view, and I can give them the exact answer, and then I don't actually follow it. Yeah. Like, I remember once a Friday night at Columbia Hillel, and we were discussing whatever we can use a water, something you're allowed to use a water cooler on Shabbat or not, like from an Orthodox point of view. And I gave this whole like complicated answer from an halachic perspective, depending on which what kind of water cooler is and how it works and so on. And then we walk out, and if you know at Columbia campus, but we walk down Broadway, we get to 116, and I walk into the train. And sometimes I think it does challenge people a lot when they see someone with so much knowledge not following it, because a lot of people want to believe that if only you knew better, you would do better, so to speak, with quotation marks. So it's a big challenge, but at the same time, it's a power. I think being able, for someone like me to be able to say, yeah, I know everything, not, I obviously don't know everything, but I know a lot of what Orthodoxy has to offer. And I still think that Reform Jews are just as good and maybe even better Jews than Orthodox Jews. I'm not saying yes or no, I'm saying hypothetically, that gives a power that a lot of people don't want to give to non-Orthodox Jews. And I think that is a power that we have to use more and maybe even abuse more. I'm not shying away from saying that.
I love that. Let's use our power. Thank you so much, Abby Stein, for joining us. This has been a fantastic conversation.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Lax. This has been amazing. For anyone who wants, the book is available. I always send people, go on Hashed Book Group, their website, and you just look it up. You can just Google it. You will find the book, Becoming Eve. It's available to order on everyone from corporate websites to independent websites to bookstores. And let me all know what you think.
You heard her. Let her know what you think. And we'll close out this episode by asking you to let us know what you think, too. We always love hearing from listeners about whether it's this episode or a bunch of episodes or whatever floats your boat. We love hearing from you. And here are all the different ways that you can be in touch with us at Judaism Unbound. First, there is our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. That's, you know, the name, our name. And next is our Twitter feed, which you can find at Judaism Unbound. Third, you can go to our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can hit us up via email at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. One plug that we're going to make this time is that we talked about, you know, that B'nai B'rak test, that idea or question of whether we feel a connection with Jews who are deeply different from us in background, in practice, in political ideology, in all sorts of ways. Stay tuned, because there's going to be a really cool bonus episode coming to you very soon from our New Voices Judaism Unbound fellow, Rina Yehuda Newman, that looks at that question and other questions, but largely that one through a really interesting lens. So little shameless plug for that. And we'll close out with one other request, which is that we deeply appreciate any amount of financial donation that you're able to send our way. And you can send us that at judaismunbound.com/donate on either a monthly recurring basis or just as a one-time gift. So thank you so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.